It's not for the reading. We just have a few verses to cover tonight, but a very powerful, very sort of radical, not necessarily interpretation, we'll talk about that, but an extension or expansion of the old law that this audience would have been familiar with. You have Jesus, this prophet who was maybe relatively unknown. Maybe a lot of people had gathered there in those multitudes there up on the mountain. And maybe they didn't know who this man was. And they're listening to someone speak, and he's talking about the prophets and the old law. And then all of a sudden, he's going to say some things that you can imagine a lot of eyebrows raising and a lot of people looking to their friends to the side and their family members and being like, do you hear that? Do you hear what he's saying? And so it's pretty amazing and pretty alters the entire timeline of everything and begins to institute what we think of now as New Testament doctrine. So sort of recap what we studied last time was verses 17 through 20. I wanted to read those just to catch us up. Jesus said, chapter 5 of Matthew, verse 17, do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you, that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. And this set of verses to discuss tonight, verse 21 to 26, is a direct extension. It exactly follows from what we just read, what Jesus just said about fulfilling the law. And now he's going to give several examples through the rest of chapter 5, and we're going to study one particular example tonight. Austin, I believe the first question is for you. What commandment is being referred to in verse 21 by Jesus, and were there any exceptions to this commandment in the Old Testament?
Okay, so the commandment is the sixth commandment? Mm-hmm. Okay, make sure I got that right. I knew where it was. I couldn't remember the number of the commandment. Exodus 20, verse 13, thou shalt not kill, reiterated in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 17, again, thou shalt not kill. And as far as exceptions are concerned, I think when you're looking at the exception, that would be where God would specifically command to, as a means of righteous judgment or punishment, such as stoning that would occur if one perhaps broke the Sabbath or some other command, wars against unrighteous nations, and also sin within the camp, such as when the children of Israel committed fornication or idolatry in those instances.
Thank you very much. Who else would like to comment on this first question? Yes, Matt.
There is a philosophical debate as to what constitutes murder, of course, in the Old Testament. Is God sending Israel, to, as Austin said, to execute his righteous judgment? Is that murder? Or is it something else? Murder is to take someone's life, but if all life belongs to God, are you murdering somebody if you're doing it in righteous judgment? I don't really know the answer to that, but there is a large philosophical debate as to whether or not the killing for the righteous judgment in the case of stoning or whatever punishment was carried out or destruction of the Canaanites or the Amalekites, maybe that wasn't murder.
Who wants to give their opinion on the philosophy of murder? Lauren first and then Bill.
Well, I'll enter the philosophical debate. Exodus 21, 12 to 14. And he who strikes a man so that he dies, he shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, and I will prepare for you a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar and that he may die. So there is, several commentators pointed to this very verse, that this is a treachery that stems from hate is what murder, or the death that stems from hate is what murder is. So in Deuteronomy 20 and 13, there is the command to kill in war. So, but that is an exception. Here it is still premeditation. If you listen to like some of the news stories this week about the terrorist that was killed, you know, there's a lot of information about that, and you realize how they were hunting. They were hunting like you'd hunt a predator, and that, so it was premeditated. And under the Old Testament law, there was an exception to the punishment. It was still murder. Accidental killing was not deemed murder. If you look in Deuteronomy 19, there was still bloodshed imputed for an accidental killing. They had to flee to a city during that time, but the bloodshed was still there. It had to be an accounting against the killer for that bloodshed. An exception to that is in Exodus 22, verses 2 and 3. There we see what we would term today self-defense, when a person broke into somebody's house and the homeowner defended his life and life of his family. He was not held accountable for that, and there was no bloodshed accounted for that.
Mm-hmm. The first example that you gave in Exodus 21:12, you said if the killing is driven by hate, and that's exactly what Jesus is talking about. That's exactly the entire discussion of these set of verses, is murder isn't just the act, it's the hate that's on the inside. Thank you very much. Bill.
The Lord hit about all of my points, except I have one illustration with regard to war, and that would be 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 5. In this passage, David's speaking to Solomon. David's close to dying. He's speaking to Solomon about Joab's shedding the blood of war during peacetime. So it's kind of, that it was wrong, and inferring that, you know, this is the idea that, you know, God sometimes commands Israel, and God himself killed many at different times, at times of war. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, I hate even saying the word holy war, but it's kind of like a war that the Lord endorses and commands Israel. That would be a wartime shedding of blood, and the Lord's condoning that. And, you know, he's requiring that. So, so there's maybe a passage that helps us understand that there's a wartime and there's a peacetime. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Dennis, did you have your...
Just pretty much agree with everything that's been said. The 1 Samuel 15, 1 through 3, God orders his people to kill even infants and children. Mm-hmm. It's not the only place. I think it pertains to the individual. Like you said, hate, you know, murder has to begin with hate in the heart before it ends up being murdered.
Right.
So I don't think it's a prohibition against a nation having a police force or a military, because Romans 13:4 is that, you know, the government does not wield a sword in vain.
Yeah, and I think we'll talk about that. At least I have notes about that when we get to the obeying civil law versus scripture and things like that. Just to add one further bit of information, I also had delineated between shedding blood because you are punishing someone for a crime, following a scriptural command to do so. Everyone mentioned that, but just to sort of list some of the sins that we've discussed, many of these, since I've been here, we went through Deuteronomy. Before that, I think everyone studied through Leviticus. We've seen a lot of these. Death penalty was the punishment for murder, the punishment defined or dictated by God. For murder, incest, bearing false witness, adultery, idolatry, especially bestiality, human sacrifice to pagan gods, cursing a parent, fortune telling, many other things. And we can see these all throughout those books of Exodus and Leviticus, especially some in Deuteronomy. Question 2. Bill, this will be for you. Is Jesus clarifying the Old Testament command or teaching New Testament doctrine in verse 22?
Well, the short answer, in my opinion, is both. The long answer was kind of long. It was suggested that the phrase without a cause was added by early scribes and that it isn't found in the early manuscripts. To this point, the American Standard, the New American Standard Version, the Revised Standard Version, they don't even have this phrase without a cause in the passage. To allow this phrase is to allow anger against a brother. So you can kind of see how, you know, if this phrase is, okay, well, I have a cause, so I can take this position, I can do this thing. Through these verses, Jesus is teaching a difficult way of thinking and to be able to act and behave without anger, and that's a challenge. Judgment, you know, as in the first verse, this judgment here refers to the local authorities, not the final judgment. But we can conclude that anger, as being described in this verse, could certainly put a Christian at a guilty distance before God. Council, believed to be the Sanhedrin, and am I getting out of my verse? Yeah, Raca, you fool. It was suggested that calling someone a name like this demonstrates disrespect to God, and to slander the creation is slandering the Creator. And I think I could use some coaching and restraint in that area, because sometimes I try to be cute, and if you're not careful, you say things. You start pushing the envelope and getting in an area where you shouldn't be. So I appreciated this verse.
Agreed. Who would like to add? Matt?
I think a lot of what Jesus does is say, well, he doesn't say that these actions are now permissible. He says every action has a motive behind it. These actions, you know these actions are wrong, but there are motives behind these actions that are also wrong, because that's what leads to the action. The action is wrong, but it's wrong because of what it comes out of. If adultery and fornication come out of lust, those things are wrong. Murder comes out of hate. Hate is wrong. John says in 1 John 3:15, whoever hates his brother is a murderer. So the motives is what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying the motives are just as important as the final result. So you need to be pure in your action, but you have to be pure in your thought as well, because one or the other is going to cut it.
Yeah, agreed. But I also think there's a slight twist on that, which is in the context of the Pharisees, it's that avoiding the action doesn't mean you've avoided the motive, right? So not murdering isn't enough, is the point here. But yeah, very, very good points. Yes, Austin.
To kind of build off that, talks about, of course, in verse 19 about the least of these commandments. And I would think in a Pharisee's mind, this would be a prime example of a lesser command. Well, if you can't, if I can't kill him, I can still hate him. I'm not murdering him. Jesus here is saying that they're all one and the same. The not doing the action doesn't get rid of the motive. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and thinking of the least of these being maybe the easiest of these, it's pretty easy to not murder someone, I mean, in my experience, you know? And so maybe he does start with this to say, like, here's one that you think you have no trouble avoiding, but you do, and let me show you why. Trace?
I don't know if this verse was quoted already, but 1 John 3:15, it says, whoever hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. So
yeah,
it's very straightforward.
And I'm sure the author there had Jesus' teaching in mind.
Yeah.
Lauren, did you have your hand up? I thought of James. Of course, I've been going through the book of James, and so it's often on my mind. And in James 2:14 says, what does it profit if someone says they have faith, but they don't have works? And when I went over this chapter, when I studied it, what we talked about was there's this idea of people saying that they have faith, professing that they're religious, but they don't show anything. And so no one from the outside can see that. And so you can be as religious as you want when you come here on Wednesday or Sunday, then you go to work, and people would be surprised that you go to church because you never do anything. There's never any behavior or sign. There's no outward portrayal of what you say is on the inside. I think Jesus is talking about the opposite here. He's talking about people, the Pharisees, who have the outward, the behaviors are, you know, to the letter. The Pharisees are following every jot and tittle of the law without any exceptions, right? They're doing everything that the letter says they should do. But on the inside, they don't actually have the faith. They don't have the spirit of the law, and they're not actually righteous and faithful. They just appear that they are. And so this is an important theme throughout, I think, at least in my reading, throughout Jesus' teaching, is what's on the inside? What's on the interior? What's your actual personal self like versus just how you behave or how other people see you? No one can see what's happening in your mind or in your soul except you and God, and we have to reconcile that. Okay, question number 3. What's wrong with saying the phrases Raca and thou fool? Are they inherently wrong to say, or is Jesus referring to something else? Hunter, would you like to answer this one?
Sure. I can be the most in-depth answer in the world. As far as Raca, if I remember correctly, it means empty head, just essentially calling somebody stupid, just not very intelligent, you're degrading them in some manner, whereas that fool is more, it's a little bit more derogatory, and it's something, as if I understand it correctly, was a saying that the Jews used back in the day to kind of describe idolaters and people that committed a little bit more heinous crimes. But either way, it's speech that is very degrading and very insulting. And so, while it's not necessarily wrong to use stupid in a sentence or anything, but when you're talking about another human being, a brother, especially a brother, someone who is close to you, when you're using that sort of speech, again, like we've been talking about, you're murdering them with your words and violating that commandment. That's the premise.
Thank you. Who would like to comment on that? Or?
Interesting thing about this in Jude, where it talks about Michael, the archangel, contending with the devil, reviling. It said, God rebuke you. So even at these, and even in the angelic realm, it's wrong to have this derogatory sense.
I hadn't put that together. That's interesting. Bill?
Yeah, I think when we part of, and Hunter maybe got a little close to touching on this, part of it is that there's an aspect of this that's one's tone of voice, you know, how you are attacking someone with your words, and it's revealing of the one that's doing the attacking, their character. So we have that in mind. Well, then we flip the table over and we go over to passages like chapter 23, verses 17 and 19, Mark chapter 3, verse 5, John chapter 2, verse 15, John chapter 6, verse 70. These are passages where Jesus spoke this way, getting angry with the Pharisees, Jesus called them fools. So, you know, certainly Jesus knew the hearts of these Pharisees, so he truly knew where they were at. So he was, I guess, maybe more so, it wasn't an attack as much as statement, a fact. He knew that and dealt with it accordingly.
Any other comments here? Yes, awesome.
It's also interesting that he points out very much dissimilar from the old law in the fact that now these, the hatred has eternal consequences. He talks about, you know, if you murder someone, you're in danger of the council. If you say Raca, you're in danger of the council, but now you're in danger of hellfire. And bringing their attention to the fact that there's bigger things going on than the hierarchy, because now you're this is how you look in the eyes of God.
I think that's right, yeah. So, I'm going to throw something out there and see what you think about this. So, we have in verse 22, we have these three statements. Whoever is angry with his brother, without a cause, maybe added later, shall be in danger of the judgment. Whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. Whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Now, some people, and maybe everyone here tonight has this view, and I think maybe this is the main one that I've ever heard from the pulpit, but when I was studying to moderate tonight, I sort of dug a little deeper. So Kaufman says that, or actually let me give a little bit of context to those terms. Judgment refers to sort of a city tribunal, a local court of law. It would be similar to like a lower circuit court that we have, a county court. The council is the Sanhedrin. This was the Jewish Old Testament version of like the Supreme Court. And then hellfire, or the Gehenna fire, referred to a specific place, the Valley of Hinnom. In the Valley of Hinnom, idolatrous Israelites, this is where, I can't remember who spoke on it recently, but there was this idol of Moloch, and they would heat up this idol, and it would become this molten statue, and they would sacrifice children on it. It was an extremely wicked place. And this is going to get very... you're going to have some imagery here from Barnes. Albert Barnes, commentator, says, after the return of the Jews from captivity, this place, the Valley of Hinnom, was held in such abhorrence that by the example of Joshua in 2 Kings 23:10, it was made the place where they would throw all dead carcasses, and filth of the city was not infrequently the place of public executions. It became, therefore, extremely offensive. The sight was terrific. The air was polluted and pestilential. To preserve it in any manner pure, it was necessary to keep fires continually burning there. The extreme loathsomeness of the place, the filth and putrefaction, the corruption of the atmosphere, the lurid fire blazing by day and night, made it one of the most appalling and terrifying objects with which a Jew was acquainted. It was called the Gehenna of Fire and was the image which Jesus often employed to denote the future punishment of the wicked. So you have this... You have like sort of degrees here. You have local court, Supreme Court, and then you have this extreme, terrifying, terrible place of punishment. And so Bernie Kaufman argues, like many commentators do, that saying Raca, saying thou fool, that these are equivalent, and that the message here is just don't insult your brother. Right? But because we have this hierarchy of worse and worse judgments through the courts and all that, there's this other idea that again, going to Barnes, thou fool, he says, was a term that expressed more than stupidity, as Hunter mentioned, more than wanting in wisdom. It was expressive of the highest guilt, and it was commonly used to denote those who were idolaters in Deuteronomy 22, and also one who is guilty of great crimes in Joshua 7 and Psalm 14. And so, he that hates his brother without a cause is guilty of a violation of the sixth commandment, and shall be punished with certain sorts of punishment, but he who has hate in his heart is going to have this worse punishment. And so the idea here, I know I've been talking a long time, but the idea I think that makes sense to me is you can sort of read it as if you say that someone is stupid or call them lame brain or whatever, relatively minor insult, that's not okay to do. But if you say thou fool, which Jesus uses later, like Bill pointed out, that's serious and that's extreme. And so I don't know if the idea that Kaufman has that this is just saying any insult, they're all equally bad. This is saying you can say things that are extremely wicked to someone else. And you can say things that are also a problem, but that problem will be dealt with in a different way. And so I don't know that it is that the takeaway here is that every insult is going to lead you to hell. I think it's that the ones that are based in hate and wickedness and extremely just hate-filled things to say, which is what, to us, we read thou fool, it doesn't sound like that. But some commentators say that that was an extremely, extremely harsh thing to say. So, I don't know. Sorry for talking so long. Okay. We will move on to question four, unless anyone wants to get into it without that. We can do that afterwards. Question four says, according to verses 23 and 24, which party has the obligation to go and make amends in the event of a disagreement? Dennis.
Well, it would appear to be the you, the person who's hearing it. This person remembers that his brother has some problem with him. You should try to be the initiator, trying to resolve that problem. It gets down to, I think, the golden rule in actually practicing it. Matthew 7:12 says, therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. But this is a law and the prophets. And of course, we all have a broken relationship, hindered our relationship with God. If we realize someone has a grievance against us, but we also know that maybe it's coming from them, and we should treat them the way that we would like to be treated, love them more than we love ourselves, and go to them, initiate the healing process, and you can be assured that no matter what the outcome, that you have done all that you can do to resolve that matter. That was 12:18 passage.
Thank you. Yes, Lauren.
This is a continuation of what Jesus said earlier in the chapter. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. So, peacemakers, anybody.
Mm-hmm. Who would like to add? Matt?
The idea of bringing a gift to the altar is not one that we're familiar with, really, in the Christian religion. It's not something that we do. We don't bring physical gifts or sacrifices, those sorts of things, to altars. And Bart is not here to challenge me on this, but Bart, in our discussion after last week, he said, why would Jesus give these commandments to these people for the next 2 years? And what... These have much further reaching implications to them, and I totally agree with that. But this certainly is something that would have been a short term in the literal sense of bringing a gift to the altar. Now, we can say that bringing your gift to the altar could be praying, it could be coming to worship services, whatever it is, and we can say that's bringing your gift to the altar, though that's not explicit here at all. But in terms of bringing a gift to the altar, this is certainly talking to a Jewish audience who is definitely still going to be following the Jewish law, and Jesus is encouraging that here, which makes the rest of the passage so much more difficult when all of these things get interwoven into it. But certainly the principle is farther reaching, but the immediate context is definitely following the Jewish law here.
Yeah, and Bart's not here to say his side, but I'm already going to say I think both sides are correct. Who would like to add? Lauren?
Didn't have it ready when I said it before. But this proverb, it's kind of neat the way it says this. A brother offended is harder to win than a strong city, and contentions are like bars of a castle.
Any other thoughts? Bill?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, because of this principle, you know, oftentimes we hear people talk about when there is a disagreement, well, why does he come talk to me about it? Well, he's the one that messed it up. He should be the one that has to fix it. I think this principle is teaching that it doesn't matter who's even necessarily in the right or the wrong. If you know that there's a problem, then, like Dennis said, it's the you that needs to come fix it. So if we're truly following this principle, so many of the disagreements that have went on in the church should have been resolved long before they were.
I like what Matt said, and I think it's important to keep, and I was, because I've got the study next week, and I was kind of thinking, as you did introduce reading back these other verses, this it's important to keep setting the stage, you know, where we're at, who the audience that Jesus has, to Matt's point. Then I think that's it'll help us. Maybe it is short term. This is only going to be, you know, 2 or 3 year type of thing. But Jesus is trying to reinforce and encourage these people that they're Jews. That's all they've ever known. And now he's trying to, you know, here's how I want you to think different. So I back to the original question, you know, it's almost like, you know, the God-fearing believer, the maybe it's two God-fearing believers, I don't know, but the somebody's got to want to please God, and above being right or wrong, being right or trying to prove somebody wrong. It's more, there's more to it than that. It's let's get this taken care of, get back on the same page, you know, and that's the person that's wanting to get this right, you know, that's the person that is pleasing to God and that knows that that's the kind of person God wants them to be. This word reconcile, I liked it a lot. So I don't remember where I come across the phrase, but the word reconcile, it includes the idea of mutual hostilities toward each other and then mutual concessions. Mm-hmm. That's working it out. I like that, mutual hostilities.
Yeah, and we know from experience, and we read the term throughout the Bible of someone having their heart hardened. That takes time. And that can happen if you don't make this resolution quickly. And we'll see in a few verses, agree with your adversary quickly. As soon as you recognize there's a problem, go to the person. Not only do you not say, well, wait for them to come to me, like Austin brought up, whoever knows there's a problem, as soon as you know, go solve it quickly. Otherwise, that's when bad feelings could eventually turn into hate and someone could be resentful. And now they're not talking to you anymore and you don't know why, and then it's too far to fix it, all those things. We all know, we've all seen these things happen in our personal lives. Okay, moving on to question number 5. Do our personal relationships affect our relationship with God? Grant, or Matt?
Well, the context of the passage is a lot narrower than the question itself. The answer to the question itself is absolutely. In the context of the passage and the verses that are quoted, there can scarcely be any doubt, because Jesus says, if you are going to offer a gift to the Lord, if you're going to make some sort of sacrifice or offering, but you know that something isn't right between you and your brother, then there's no point in you making that offering. So in this context, absolutely we can't deny that if you're not right with your brethren, then you cannot be right with God. Your sacrifice is meaningless because you have other problems before you get there. It's the motives that we talked about. If you're coming to God, but there's something in the background that is not good, then why are you even doing it? Is what Jesus is saying here. And in the broader context, and we won't belabor this too much, but Paul says that evil company corrupts good habits, 1 Corinthians 15:33. The entire book of Proverbs is pretty much about the people that you surround yourself with and what a good wife will do to you, what a promiscuous woman will do to you, what a contentious woman, or evil people that lay in wait to do harm to people, what that will do to your soul. So the question itself has far broader implications than just this context, but I think the answer in this context and biblically as a whole is yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Other comments on question number 5?
I think one of the aspects of these two verses that's being demonstrated here is that being reconciled with another is more important than the sacrifice. And I think that we should, I think we can, if we're not careful, we can have the attitude or the behavior that we might think that our worship service to God is more important than our relationships with others. You know, I think if we think, I think there can be situations and times if we, that maybe if we're not careful, we can use the excuse of worship and using that as an excuse to be mean and hurtful to other people. And I think that aspect's in here as well. I probably didn't explain it very well, but I hope you know what I was trying to get to.
I think so. Mark?
So the parallel today, when we read it often in communion in 1 Corinthians 11, it tells us in verses 27 through 29 to examine ourselves and drink of the cup worthily. And if we're thinking about stressful situations with people we know and so forth, we're not thinking about Jesus at that time. We need to get those things taken care of before we worship.
I have the same set of verses, but went in this sort of different route, which is partaking in an unworthy manner. And one of the ways that you could be doing that would be if you have hate in your heart, if you're feeling hateful towards someone, if you have said some of these things that you shouldn't have said, for example, and then you are partaking of communion, partaking of the Lord's Supper, and so it looks like you're worshiping. You look just like the Pharisees looked. And think about, I was thinking while Matt was answering this question, the Pharisees, who some of them would have been in this audience, or people in the audience certainly knew them, they would never not take a gift to the altar. They would never stop and set their gift down and go on their way. That would never happen. And so for someone to stand there and say, you might as well not even worship because your heart isn't right, that's probably pretty extreme for that audience there. But I went to 1 Corinthians 11 as well. Any other comments? Okay, last question. Should we handle civil disputes the same way that we would handle a dispute with a brother in Christ, referring to the last couple of verses here? Grant, would you like to answer this one?
Sure. The first half here, a dispute among men that's being brought before men versus a dispute with, let's say, a brother that's being essentially before God. The two courts are very different. The higher standard should be certainly the dispute against man before God. I think that's a higher standard that we need to make sure to try to live by, and that the disputes we have against other people, we certainly have a standard by which we need to live by, but I think that the standard is much higher for this group with our brothers. And we do see in Romans 12, verse 18, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. We certainly have a command to do what we can to live peaceably with men and do what, and to live civilly and to do what we can to help them out. But there's certainly a higher expected role for us with our brethren, which means that we don't necessarily just give everything. If somebody sues us for our house or for a car or for anything in our possession, we don't immediately just necessarily give it over. We have a responsibility to provide for families and other things that we need to do. But if it really comes to us, we go even an extra mile to help them out and to do what we can to reconcile all the differences between us and them.
Very good. Any other thoughts on this question? Okay, I will add one thing. Pulpit Commentary points out that the word adversary here is antiduco. It's defined as one's opponent in a matter cognizable by law. So it's something that could be a legal dispute. Something happened between you and your neighbor, and it's something that there's a problem, and there's potential that that could end up in court. And so this example here is, I think in both of these verses 25 and 26, is explicitly a civil law case. It's saying, if something happens and it could go to court, don't let that happen. And I think what Jesus is doing here is he's giving an example from common sense and from how people would live their life, right? And so in today's terms, you accidentally, your tree fell on your neighbor's yard, and you're afraid that they're going to sue you for damages. you go over immediately and you say, hey, what can we do to fix this? Like, how can I help you to get this covered so that we, you don't end up in court? And I think that's common reaction now, is try to settle things as it would have been then. With, again, the extra meaning about spiritual punishment and spiritual reconciliation and things like that. And so I think the example here is common sense. And if you agree with that common sense, you should agree that it applies when you're talking about your brothers and sisters in the church. Erase those problems immediately, because we don't just have a judge in a court somewhere. We have the judge to answer to later. Any last thoughts? Yes, Austin.
Just briefly, kind of build on that. We have a tendency sometimes to crave justice and to want things to be fair. And I think when you look at these principles and what he'll discuss later on in the chapter as well, the prime thing is not always for things to be fair. And sometimes when you're faced with the decision of whether something has to be fair or whether you're going to get your fair share, that it's important to choose mercy, because that's what God does with each and every one of us.
Yes, Dennis.
I think Paul expands on that in Romans, or 1 Corinthians 6, which is, why not just let yourself be cheated? You know? Just
right.
Basically, when you deal with a brother, you know, that's, you're loving him, right?
Yeah,
I think insisting on your own rights.
Right, and again, I'm sure Paul had Jesus' words in mind when he was writing.